You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Friday, August 28th. 2020.
Implicit bias, white privilege, or the Marxist origins of Black Lives Matter.
Later in the program, WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti talks to Abby Ang, local activist and scholar, about alt-right flyers found at Indiana University. More in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Diane Walker, attorney for the District 10 Pro Bono Project and Limestone Post magazine contributor, continues her ongoing series titled Eviction Crisis in Indiana. But first, your local headlines.
Here are three headlines you need to know today. WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti filed today's local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Friday, August 28th. I'm Aaron Comforti. 832 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Indiana on Thursday, according to the Indiana State Department of Health, which also attributed 8 new deaths to the disease. Locally, Monroe County saw 21 positive cases reported on Thursday, while Brown and Greene counties both reported 1 new case. Indiana University has not yet published the COVID-19 dashboard that it promised in a town hall meeting last month. The university's COVID-19 statistics are not publicly available at the moment. Late yesterday evening, IU announced that it suspended all organizational activities at every sorority and fraternity and at the Evans Scholars and Christian Student Fellowship houses. The suspension of activities affects some 2,600 students. The Monroe County Health Department ordered 8 of the fraternities and sororities to not only suspend organizational activities, but to adhere to a strict quarantine by not leaving their houses. In a meeting on Wednesday night for the city's Public Safety Committee, City Council member Isabel Piedmont-Smith asked Bloomington Police Chief Mike Dekoff if systemic racism is present in the Bloomington Police Department. Dekoff responded this way.
I do not believe that there is systemic racism in our agency. I believe that we have a very forward-thinking department. I believe our officers don't have racist thoughts, don't participate in racist activities.
Dekoff's comments brought swift condemnation from local activists. That's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Aaron Comforti.
The Bloomington City Council Public Safety Committee held a public meeting to discuss the Bloomington Police Department. BPD Chief Michael Dekoff said police officers receive 90 to 100 hours of training each year. He said Indiana only requires 24 hours. He said the department seeks new training each year.
Each year we will look at previous trainings and what was taught and look for new programming to see what keeps it fresh. You know, the one thing with some of the state training is it's the same stuff every year. And there's in some of those topics, there's not much that you can change. But again, you get it year after year and it becomes quite repetitive. Some of the more hot button topic training issues, we try to get different perspectives on those.
Dekoff said BPD owning an armed vehicle is not militarization. He said militarization is about actions, not equipment. Councilmember Isabel Piedmont-Smith asked Dekoff about BPD's ownership and use of non-lethal weaponry.
We do have less lethal guns that we use that are converted shotguns that fire beanbag rounds or sponge rounds. And those are used, those are actually carried by patrol officers because they encounter situations all the time where they might need access to that type of of a weapon quickly. And situations that those are used in would be someone maybe with a knife threatening suicide, some kind of weapon that's not a gun.
Dekoff said legal tear gas would be used in a mass riot situation. He said some areas of law enforcement have seen racism. However, racism is not part of BPD, and officers do not have racist thoughts. He said officers are monitored with body cameras and held accountable by a guardian tracking system. Community member Jada B. questioned Dekoff's assessment of racism.
I take extreme exception to Chief Dekoff's insisting that his police force is a not racist police force, that none of them even have a racist thought in their brain. That is a grotesque interpretation of what is racism and what is racist in this country. I would like to know what criteria he is basing that assessment on. Who gave him that assessment? Were there any Black people or brown people involved in making that assessment of his police force, given the fact that his police force is mostly white and that he himself is white? So who is it that is giving him this idea that his police force is not racist? I have report after report after report from Black people in this community saying that they are continually harassed by the police force in this town.
B said Bloomington and BPD are not outside of current events. Resident Savannah Perlman said officers choose to be officers, but people don't choose to be Black. Community member Danielle Bird said social workers should not be involved with BPD.
Social workers employed by police is not a progressive move at all. It's misguided to align social work with law enforcement. Social workers should never be used as agents of social control or seen as part of the law enforcement system. It harms our profession in other ways that we're working with folks. We definitely can provide social work outside of the law enforcement. I know social workers are of value to the community. I just want to point out in Eugene, Oregon, CAHOOTS, which is a crisis intervention program, was able to respond to 20% of the area's 911 calls last year. And through that program, teams of medics and experienced mental health professionals are dispatched to handle certain emergencies instead of the police.
Local law student William Sanchez said BPD officers must be wearing masks. Dekoff said officers are required to wear masks while interacting with the public. Piedmont Smith said BPD has used no-knock warrants. Dekoff said he could not guarantee a no-knock warrant situation would not lead to a death.
Indiana University Kelley School of Business professor Eric Rasmussen has been put on unpaid leave for what IU is calling a, quote, personal issue, end quote. The announcement comes after a series of sexist tweets Rasmussen made last week. Rasmussen's comments were in response to a tweet suggesting parents would rather their daughters be, quote, sexually immoral, end quote, and get a degree, which the tweet called, quote, divorce insurance, end quote, than get married young. Rasmussen responded to this tweet, saying, quote, those girls are really showing off their legs. And I could see girls sitting alone just hoping for a friend, even a female friend, maybe, end quote. Rasmussen has been under investigation for comments like this since November of last year, IU spokesperson Chuck Carney confirmed to Indiana Public Media. Rasmussen drew national attention when he tweeted a link to an article titled, quote, are women destroying academia? Probably, end quote, which implied that geniuses were overwhelmingly male. Rasmussen is on unpaid leave for the rest of the academic year. As of this recording, IU has taken no further actions.
Ellettsville Town Council discussed payment options and shutoff policies for residents behind on utility payments. The Indiana moratorium on utility shutoffs ended on August 14th. Town Manager Mike Farmer said 734 of 5,500 customers are behind on payments during their August 24th meeting.
A lot of those are current month past dues, and so that'll go down quite a bit. But we have people all the way back into January, a few customers that have not paid a bill since then. And probably in the last, or the first, from January to May, there's probably 50 customers that would be multi-month delinquent.
Farmer said the amount of past due payments is around $83,000. Farmer said 6 months was the advised amount of time given to customers to repay their debt. However, it could be extended. He said customers must pay current bills, but this could burden their ability to make past due payments.
You know, I might suggest that we have a amount where they could go 12 months, and anything under that amount, then we would go to 6 months. So I would hate to have to take a $50 past due bill and split it up in 12 payments. So maybe somewhere like $250, since I give you a $50 to $500 range on bills, maybe at $250, they would have the option to go 12 months and anything under that 6 months.
Farmer said any past due bills during the moratorium would not be charged a late fee. However, current late bills would be charged a 10% late fee. Commissioner William Ellis said anyone delinquent in January, February, and March of 2020 should be treated differently and not waive the 10% late fee. He said they should not have been affected by COVID.
If the bill for January, February, and March combined was $100, they get the 10% fee on that. They got $10 extra. So we're not continually assessing fees or anything. It's a one-time fee, but I don't think they should be treated any different than the ones that paid their bills before COVID hit.
Farmer said a late payment and disconnect notice would be sent out to residents with information on how to make payment arrangements. Farmer said no utilities would be shut off until September 15th. Council members agreed on requiring at least $10 payments per month for 12 months until the cost is covered. Also during the meeting, council members approved an amendment to the town code allowing residents to keep a total of 9 fowl, including ducks. Resident Valerie DeWar was concerned about duck mating.
Are all ducks equally vicious in their mating habits? Because there are certain ones that just really do make quite a spectacle. And I don't know that if I had young children in the neighbor yard next door, I particularly want that.
Council members clarified no male ducks would be allowed to be kept. Councilmember Ellis said constituents expressed concern about the raised number. Councilmember Scott Oldham said allowing ducks would provide an option for farm fresh eggs to people with allergies to chicken eggs.
City Council Representative Isabel Piedmont-Smith is hosting her monthly constituent meeting on Saturday, August 29th via Zoom. Piedmont-Smith will be discussing the city's budget proposal, as well as the proposed local income tax increase. Bloomington residents are encouraged to join this meeting and bring questions and concerns to a member of Bloomington's City Council. The Zoom meeting will start at 11 a.m.
The Monroe County Commissioners approved an agreement for Indiana University to perform contact tracing. During their August 26th meeting, Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudell said the contact tracers would work with students and staff on campus.
They will be handling students and faculty on on-campus related positives for COVID-19, and they'll do the contact tracing for those. We, of course, will be working very closely with them and handling close contacts that may not be affiliated with the university.
Caudell said any community contacts with the infected student or staff would be handled by county contact tracers. She said IU has hired multiple contact tracers. She said the agreement would run through June of 2021. Also during the meeting, commissioners approved additional funding for the Hoosier Hills Food Bank and Pantry 279. Commissioner Penny Githens said the demand on food pantries is up.
Demand for food at the Hoosier Hills Food Bank is up 40% over what it was at this time last year. Last Friday, Commissioner Jones had another commitment that day, so she was unable to join us. But Commissioner Thomas and I went out to the food bank and joined the Indiana Army National Guard to help distribute the food. We were able to give food to 1,032 households.
Commissioner Julie Thomas said Hoosier Hills Food Bank would receive $25,000 and $5,000 to Pantry 279.
Now it's time for your feature reports. Up first, WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti talked to Abby Ang, activist and scholar of the No Space for Hate group. Aang talks about alt-right flyers found at Indiana University, of which NSFH calls an example of crypto-fascism or covert fascism. Here now is that interview.
There have been reports that a poster was found on the IU campus. It's causing quite a stir. Could you tell us a little bit about it, please?
Yeah, certainly. So some IU students reached out to us to let us know that they had found posters at locations such as the Wells Library. And these posters had the caption, "Are IU woke enough?" And then it had the claim that academic freedom is under attack from a small number of ultra-woke faculty. And it also encouraged IU students and staff to document and record any instances of this kind of ultra-wokeness. And the kind of words that they used, they said, they talked about struggle sessions and talked about how people are not allowed to dissent over issues like implicit bias, white privilege, or the Marxist origins of Black Lives Matter. And basically asked them to send this information to like a particular email address so that they could document what was happening. You know, like we've seen violence in the past from different groups that kind of try to recruit, recently white supremacist groups like American Vanguard and other organizations like that. And so this is kind of slightly different from that because it doesn't name a particular organization. But it sounds very, very similar to other campaigns that have happened in the past. So, for example, one thing that scholars have been told to these scholars and researchers and faculty have been told nationally to be aware of is campaigns to record videos, especially since a lot of teaching is going online. There has been a campaign from Turning Point USA from Charlie Kirk, and he told college students, he tweeted this out back in March, he said now that basically professors are switching to online classes, and he asked students to share with Turning Point videos of what he called blatant indoctrination, and he tweeted that now is the time to document and expose the radicalism that has been infecting our schools. And basically what that does is to name and shame professors who advance what they call a liberal agenda. Chronicle of Higher Ed did a good overview about the implications of this for faculty and graduate students. And they said that research shows that although many faculty can skew left politically, there's really no evidence of a kind of campaign or siege against conservative thought in the classroom. But this phrase of indoctrination is a common right-wing talking point. And because we're all moving online now, the transition to remote learning, it basically means that students have more recorded material to share. And so the concern here is that people are taking videos from classes that are taught by marginalized faculty. So what that means is Black faculty, and Black and Indigenous and people of color graduate students who might be teaching courses on diversity, Black history, African American studies, Asian American studies. And we tracked this down, this particular account that's been circulating these flyers just by searching through the hashtag. And the account that's been, Twitter account that's been tweeting these flyers basically have posted videos of faculty members, particularly Black faculty members, and have been encouraging followers to basically open these faculty up for targeted harassment from far-right people. We can't say that this is something like Turning Point USA, which, by the way, does have a chapter on campus, and the leaders of the Turning Point USA are from the Kelly School of Business, which is funded by the Koch Brothers Foundation. Because they haven't specifically identified that they're from Turning Point USA, but it sounds a lot very, very similar to that kind of campaign.
Right. And you bring up the Koch Brothers and their funding of the Kelly School of Business and the Turning Point campaign, if I'm saying that right. Maybe you could connect the dots between those different organizations and institutions for us.
Yeah, I would like to explain a little bit about Turning Point USA. And so, yeah, the Kelly School of Business does accept donations from the Koch Brothers Foundation, which also funds campus organizations called Turning Point USA. And so Turning Point USA is not declared an official hate group, but their leaders have expressed support for white supremacist members of the Boogaloo movement and have been very much aligned with far-right groups that seek to foment this kind of idea that there's a race war. Turning Point is an example of one of these far-right, very conservative, political action type of groups, kind of spread the idea that there's kind of some campaign against conservative thought, that conservative students are being oppressed and marginalized. Ideas like white privilege isn't really a thing.
And just to be clear, we're not saying that these posters are directly tied to Turning Point USA, but there's something similar in the messaging. Have you tied the posters to anyone locally?
We've not tied it to a specific person or locally. I did want to add that Turning Point USA is well known for compiling something called a professor watch list. And so what that professor watch list is a list of faculty who teach in African studies and gender studies, and it labels these folks like cultural Marxists. And so the concern here is this kind of surveillance of faculty and students who might teach anything that they deem a threat to conservative thought. A lot of graduate students teach classes like these as well, and they don't necessarily have the kind of protections that tenured faculty may have. As a graduate student myself who teaches on gender and race, that is also a concern to me personally.
What I hear you saying is that, in effect, this poster is advocating for a type of surveillance that is harming African-American, Black professors, gender studies professors, area studies, ethnic studies, etc. professors, and graduate students, instructors. Have any professors or graduate students at Indiana University reached out to you, or have you heard of any of them who have talked about harassment from this group or others like it?
Not yet, but we did see that this Twitter account had specifically named particular faculty members. And so we have made those faculty members aware. We've also reached out to IU to report the flyers and the Twitter account so just that they can do their own investigation as well. And it did, the Twitter account did feature videos of IU faculty.
And did the university respond after you notified them of the poster?
I haven't heard yet from the university, but I assume they're probably aware of it since it's been going around on social media at this point.
Okay, well, Abby Ang, thank you so much for joining WFHB and telling us about this poster that is causing a stir on the IU Bloomington campus.
Thank you.
Up next, Diane Walker, contributor of the Limestone Post magazine, continues her series titled Eviction Crisis in Indiana. Today, she resumes her conversation with Forrest Gilmore of the Shalom Community Center, Deborah Meyerson of South Central Indiana Housing Opportunities, and Jamie Sutton of Justice Unlocked.
Now, I have seen on some websites and some questions that are directed to my agency, which does legal aid, that there are some landlords who don't want to participate in the program, which I can understand the fear of maybe thinking that it's going to be a bit much, but on the other hand, it's $2,000 or 6 months rent. I would think people would be motivated for that. And you're saying that a lot of landlords that you're seeing are willing to participate in the program, correct?
So far, to my knowledge, we haven't had a landlord say no. So that's really good. We are very much in the beginning of this program. And you know, getting it all staffed up and getting it all ready. is a process, but so far we haven't had any turndowns, but it is something that we worry about, and it is a communication kind of challenge. Uh-huh. And there is a lot of paperwork that they have to sign and agree right. to. And so getting through all of that and helping them feel secure that they're not, again, not signing their life away is really important in there.
And I think that Indiana Housing Coalition and Development Authority, IHCDA, is actually launching a program to educate landlords and tenants, but I think landlords is a lot of the focus. They're using Indiana Legal Services and programs like mine in order to educate landlords that eviction last is really what should be the goal here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the challenges that we've seen, and it's interesting, and I hope we can find ways to navigate it, is this is, you know, this is the summer when a lot of leases turn over.
Right.
And so one of the issues and challenges we're seeing is not so much that people are getting evicted, but their leases are not getting renewed. Mm-hmm. And that's a significant concern because, again, anytime someone has to move, that's a great burden. And if there's any homelessness in between, that's an even greater burden. So that's been a little worrisome as well, seeing people getting around the eviction moratorium by just not renewing people's leases.
Well, that's a good question for Jamie. Jamie, do landlords in Indiana have an obligation to renew a lease? Is there anything like that in the law?
No. And although I'm only licensed to answer for Indiana, my understanding is that's pretty common everywhere. The way that real estate law works in the United States, there's very rarely an obligation to renew the lease. Typically, the only time you'll see that kind of obligation is sometimes landlords and tenants will have a lease contract that sets automatic renewal terms, right? That unless either the landlord or the tenant gives in writing some sort of notice, often 30 days or 60 days, the lease will automatically renew. And that is a way where landlords or tenants may find themselves in a new lease, perhaps even without intending to be. But I'd say 90 to 95% of the leases I see do not have those clauses. And the landlord can renew or not for pretty much virtually any reason at all other than discrimination against a protected class. In fact, I did a consultation at my practice just last week where someone was asking how late can my landlord tell me they're renewing my lease? Their lease is up on August 31st. Mm-hmm. They haven't heard anything from their landlord. They said, we keep asking if they're going to renew it or not, and the landlord won't give us a straight answer. Can they wait until the 31st and then suddenly tell us they're not renewing it? I said, absolutely, they can do that, to my knowledge.
And you and I have a somewhat unique position as lawyers, because we see a lot of the things that go wrong. And one of the things that we had talked about before was that this may be a time in which landlords just use the excuse of not paying rent in order to evict a client. Can you talk about that a little bit? We've seen a few things of that at District 10. We've seen a few instances of that. Have you seen any of that at Justice Unlocked?
Absolutely. And this is one of the reasons we highly encourage people to seek out mediation, to seek out resources from outside agencies before it gets to the point of an eviction. I think for all of the reasons Deborah said about how devastating evictions can be, about how difficult they are, they tend to be highly emotional for both tenants and landlords. And typically by the time a landlord has filed an eviction, you know, I will have some kind of a conversation with the tenant I'm representing about, you know, listen, I may or may not be able to win this eviction for you and defend against it, but you may not want to live there anymore because for the next year, the landlord is going to be looking for reasons to evict you, right? It may be that the landlord has, there have been lease violations in the past, or it may be that there's an interpersonal conflict, a clash of personalities. And I'll tell people, you know, we can win this one, but if you're 15 days late on your rent next month, they'll evict you again and they'll win that time. And so I think a lot of times you will see, or at least tenants will allege, my landlord's just been looking for a reason to get me out. they finally found one.